You're listening to Girovagando, the cycling podcast at the 2025 Giro d'Italia, celebrating 10 years of the cycling podcast on the ground, every day at the Giro d'Italia. Today we are in Nova Gorica.
Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, nuspicudeci cora, nuspicudeci cora.
Buonasera, il barone.
Buonasera, Daniel.
E buonasera to the debutante. Kind of making his debut, although we've had cameos before, but joining the team on a full-time basis, not only, no longer just a loan move, this is a permanent signing. Michele Pelacci, buonasera.
Let's go. Hi, everyone. We're here in Nova Gorizia, or Gorizia, at the border, Italy, Slovenia. What a stage today, yeah?
He's taking over already, Brian. I'm getting the mic. Good job I'm holding the mic. Good job I've only got two mics so I can rest it back off him. Pelacci, you just stay in your lane tonight, okay? You need to learn the ropes this evening, and then we'll slowly introduce you over the next couple of days. Brian, it was one of those days that was bittersweet, well, mainly bitter for the Giro d'Italia, in the sense that we've had a crash that has conditioned things. We've been talking about this wonderful equilibrium, this state of equilibrium that the Giro is in, so many riders in contention, and this eternal guessing game that the Giro has turned into. Who is really the strongest rider in this race? And we felt that we were going to find out, and that was going to determine the winner of this Giro d'Italia ultimately. However, today we did have a crash which has changed things somewhat, but we won't talk too much about that yet, will we, Brian? We will try to analyze, pick apart, dissect that a little bit later on. Find out, first of all, what happened. That'll be your task in the Processo alla Tappa, Brian. But Gorizia, have you experienced much of Gorizia today, Brian?
No, I haven't. No. To be honest, not really. No, I mean, I wouldn't call it road rage, but I feel like RCS have let us down a little bit this year. I've been doing the bulk of the driving for the cycling podcast in the pencil sharpener, which we've now aptly named our grey little MG vehicle. And just the signage this year has just been very below par. We've been driving around and we basically want to get as fast as traffic laws allow us from start to finish. And then when we finally get the PPO, it just disappears. And so I've had to raise my voice
a
few times.
Well, Brian, put your angst to one side for a moment, or if you can't do that, then I'll get Pelacci. One of you, just explain where we are at the moment, or explain the view, if you will.
We are in a bar. The sky is actually very cloudy, and it's about to rain again, maybe. Rain part of the stage as well, we'll talk about it. A lot of motor of the police are starting their engines, so it's a little noisy. And we're about to have glasses of wine, a spritz as well. Of course, we're in the northeast, so.
Has to be spritz obligatory. Pelacci, I noticed here, 450 for a spritz. We talked yesterday about the price cap on spritz in Padova, but 450, slightly more expensive here. Right, chaps, enough of that. I was going to say that it's a divided city, and half of it Slovenian, half of it Italian, but the outlook on the main piazza here in Gorizia this evening where we're sitting is very much Italian. Anyway, chaps, back to Treviso, back in time to this morning, a city that lives and breathes cycling. It certainly felt like that this morning. Fantastic crowds in Treviso, just outside the old Pinarello shop, and I think it's still a Pinarello shop. I have a lot of memories of going there many years ago, and Nanni Pinarello, the original, the sort of founder of the bike company, him being there. Unfortunately, he passed away a few years ago. However, that was the scene for the start of today's stage. And as always, we had a few things to tie up from yesterday. Well, first of all, I was prevented from sleeping again last night. Message arrived late in the night from Hugo Corvitz of Corvitz Corner, correcting me on my Dutch pronunciation. I suppose we'll indulge him by playing that, shall we?
Pay attention, Freebie. I want to congratulate you with the pronunciation of Timon Arensman. This was really like a Dutchman. But I'm not sure how you pronounced Quinten Hermans. I thought you pronounced something like Quinten Hermans. No, it's Quinten Hermans. And if you're talking tomorrow about Victor Campenaerts, the guy who won some years ago in Slovenia, it's Viktor Kampenaerts and not Viktor Kampenaerts, like it is Wout van Aert and not Wout van Aert.
I'm sure there'll be more of that tonight. That is, unless we avoid mentioning any Dutch or Belgian riders tonight. I might do that just to keep Corvitz at bay. We also hadn't heard from Larry for a few days.
We should rename him Hard Corvitz.
I know. Good job he wasn't here today. He'd have been podgercarring all the way to the finish line. Anyway, we haven't heard from Larry for a few days. We have, though, this evening, a very special episode of La Ransanda, because it was gatecrashed in a very welcome way by another rider in this Giro d'Italia who had high hopes for today's stage, Sam Bennett. We brought him in. We welcomed him in. So the first part of today's edition of La Ransanda is a bit of a three-way dialogue between Sam Bennett, me, and Lucky Larry, the Motown maestro. Here we are.
La Ransanda. Larry Warbassa's postcard from Italy.
Sam, we won't keep you long. We're going to bring you in because you two know each other.
Yeah,
and Larry can ask some questions as well. His training as a journalist. Sam, just quickly, how are you feeling about today's stage?
Yeah, quite okay. I think yesterday was a surprise how the GC teams opened it up. I mean, it was pretty insane. Normally, like a semi-sprint stage, you kind of leave it up to Trek and maybe Visma, and we roll in and do our thing. But it was how's that meme go? Gding, 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 engine kaput.
you're more conversant in these memes than me. What?
Do you know what I'm talking about? I haven't heard of that meme, but I'm sorry.
today I think I suppose I have to keep open-minded. The way cycling has gone, they race full gas every day. They could try and open it up or try and get rid of a few guys on the 3K kind of ramp up, or 3.5K ramp up. And then with the 7% steep climb, or 700 meter steep climb, I think there's a lot of teams with options where they can attack it, and then if it doesn't work, their sprinter's still there. And with all the corners, it can be hard to control and bring something back. It's quite technical, the circuit, even though it's quite long, and to bring back a breakaway or a strong group can be very difficult.
Well, I think Larry would empathise about the way modern racing is going and has gone. He was telling me yesterday, not had a chance to chat to anyone so far in this Giro, so that's why I thought I'd get you in today, so you can at least share a few seconds of conversation.
Yeah, I mean, have you seen your normalised power? Well, I'm fat, so maybe you have, but I haven't seen my normalised power below 300 on the stage yet.
That's probably true, except my power meter hasn't been working that well. So in the end, half the days I have like 80 watts average. So yeah, no, I don't know. But yeah, it's been hard.
Larry's been looking at memes. Sam, off you go. Good luck today. Larry, where were we? Oh, yesterday. Larry. You lost a few positions on general classification. We know that's not what you're here for.
Yeah.
But tell us about yesterday.
Yeah, as Sam just said, it was super hard. In the end, they opened it up. I mean, I knew it would be hard there, but I didn't expect them to go full as they did there.
It wasn't clear on TV, Larry, and I don't know if you saw it, but there was a sort of S-bend downhill into a little village, and the bunch was obviously strung out, and then when we saw the front of the bunch again, a split had occurred.
Yeah, so, I mean, it was quite clear to me when I looked at the Velo viewer the night before that there would be a very, very big sprint out of that little town at the bottom, because there was, like, to explain to the listeners, a short climb that, like, it was normal. It wasn't, like, crazy, crazy hard, but we rode a good pace. Smallish road, then a kind of technical descent straight into another climb. But then at the bottom of this descent, we arrived, like, into a tiny town with some very, very tight, small roads, tight corners between buildings and stuff. And so everyone knew that would be important. So, okay, we went really full over the top of this climb. There was like a huge sprint for position for the descent. And then essentially on the descent, you were kind of where you were. And even, you know, you can try to like chop some guys, dive bomb a few corners, but you weren't moving up that much. And obviously Ineos was aware that they could make this really hard. And they went just full out of this corner. And essentially they were just sprinting at the bottom. So
And well, we're coming to the end of the second week, Larry. It's been a bit of a funny second week, and today will be another flatter stage. But just generally, how do you feel you're coming out of this second week?
Yeah, I feel pretty tired, to be honest. I mean, especially considering we haven't had, like, yeah, the racing's been intense, but it hasn't been, there haven't been these crazy huge days yet, which we're going to see in the third week. So, you know, I think maybe, you know, normally there's, like, some of these really huge days earlier in a Grand Tour. And I think that, like, really makes guys think twice about racing, like, crazy hard later on. And so, you know, I guess that's something interesting for course design is, like, if you save it all for the third week, maybe you get more intense racing the first 2 weeks. But I think also it maybe leads to more closed racing because the GC stays super tight. So, you know, I think there's probably pluses and minuses.
Maybe it's going to be a Giro in which the senior citizens of the group are going to thrive in the last week. All these delicate young flowers are going to wilt in the last week, Larry.
I sure hope so. yeah. I hope this senior citizen will come around and find some good legs because, yeah, I've been feeling a little bit average, so we'll see. But
what's been your best day? When have you had your best legs in this Giro?
Probably the day that Plap won because we rode super hard that day and I actually felt quite good at the end. So, yeah, that was maybe my best day so far. So I'm hoping for more hard days with maybe a tiny bit less punch than we've had, so we'll see. But yeah, we'll see. Hopefully I can help the sprinters out a bit today, and maybe we'll have a nice finish for them.
Larry, very quickly, hang in there. And also, I just wanted to ask you, have you ever been to Slovenia? Because according to a well-known cycling results website, you've never raced there. But you might have been in there on the Giro.
In 2021 in the Giro, yeah. The same finish.
Is that the only time you've been there?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if it's exactly the same finish, but we finished in the same town, so yeah. But that day was a bit chiller because the breakaway had 17 minutes, so. Yeah.
And it rained a lot, didn't it?
I don't remember the rain being that bad, but it did rain a bit, yeah.
300 watts normalized power. That sounds like a lot, chaps, for the Giro d'Italia, although Larry sounded a little bit sceptical about whether that figure was accurate or not. Pelacci, you ride your bike. How hard is it to push 300 watts for the duration of a Giro d'Italia?
I think that's my apex. My, like, yeah.
You're on top form.
Exactly. And I can endure that for, like, 20 seconds, maybe.
Ah, come on.
But yeah, Brian, I need to be better at this. But one thing that accumulates me, that puts me together with the Motown Maestro, is our hometowns. Because he comes from Traverse City, I come from Traversetolo. So the first 8 letters, Brian, are the same between me and Larry. That's unusual, right?
This is the kind of content that listeners have got to look forward to from Michele Pelacci over the next week.
But should we at least for the part of our listeners who don't know what normalized power is? Michele, could you...
God, are you sure we want to do this?
Yeah.
It's like normal power and normalized. I don't know.
It's kind of smooth. It's kind of averaged out, isn't it? It's sort of averaged out over the duration of the period, taking into account altitude as well, taking into account climbing as well, and downhills. That's
exactly.
Basically,
yeah, exactly.
It doesn't take into account wind or altitude or other factors, but it does take into account uphills and downhills. Basically, chaps, another rider we're going to hear from before the Processo alla Tappa. It's a long prelude to today's Processo alla Tappa. I thought it was high time we checked in with Giulio Ciccone for the benefit mainly of Lionel Burney, who has been tipping him to finish on the podium of this Giro d'Italia. And we've been hearing a lot as glasses smash around us. We've been and a scout troop also files by. We've been hearing a lot about how Giulio Ciccone is a changed man on this Giro d'Italia. He's much cooler, he's much calmer.
That was the curse of Ciccone.
Yes, he's much cooler, he's much calmer, and he was cruising along in this Giro. So here was Giulio Ciccone talking to me about these changes this morning in Treviso. Giulio, everyone on your team is saying this is a different Giulio Ciccone this year. He's no longer getting really upset when he has a bad day. He's no longer getting emotional when he has a bad day. Is it true?
Yeah, I think it's true. And but he's it's never easy, I would say, because I think the hard part it needs to start, and till now I think we never had a really bad day, and I don't want to say it was easy, but it was more easy to manage. I think the last part will be really difficult, and we need to be ready for all scenario, and yeah, but I'm really confident to do a good finale, and we are ready for it.
If you have changed a little bit, why? What's the reason? How are you managing to stay calmer than you used to be?
I think it's always hard to explain, but yeah, in the end, when you have a good shape, you always need to believe that one black day can happen and bad day, it's always there, but also with the good legs and good condition. So I think I need to stay on these things and don't think all the rest.
Have you had any bad days in this Giro, any days when your legs haven't felt good?
I mean, not every day, but for example, yesterday for me was an hard day, and like I say, I was suffering more than expectation, and so I will not say it was a bad day, but it was an hard day.
Are you thinking about winning the Giro?
It's always a big goal, and we tried already a few times, also 2 days ago, 3 days ago, when Carapaz won. Was main goal to try to win the stage, and yeah, it's never easy when you do GC also win the stage, but it's our goal and we want to continue fight for it.
Last one, I've been asking the other GC riders, they think that Del Toro is the strongest GC rider in the race at the moment. Would you agree?
Yeah, I already said a few days ago that for me he looks stronger, and yeah, he showed another time yesterday. But I think the last week will be completely different scenario in the race. We do many long climbs, and I don't want to say that something can change. He's still the strongest, but for sure will be different moment in the race.
Well, it unfortunately wasn't going to be a very good day for Giulio Ciccone. We're going to find out why. It's time for the Processo alla Tappa.
Il Processo alla Tappa, the post-stage inquisition.
Brian, what happened today in the Giro d'Italia, please?
Thank you, Daniel. You know, when I sat down in the Sala Stampa, I thought this was going to be an easy one. Alas, it wasn't. Stage 14 from Treviso to Nova Gorizia, 195 kilometers. After some initial attacking, a solid group was established, initially consisting of five riders. Eventually, Luis Mainz decided otherwise. Then it was four: Kasper Asgreen, Clément David, Mirko Maestro, and Martin Marcelusi. They went away. Didn't really get much of a gap, sort of hovering around 2 minutes. Then it started raining, then it stopped again. Marcelusi took the first sprint at Talmasson with 94 to go. Mirko Maestri won the Red Bull sprint with 62 to go. With 39 to go, Clément dropped. At the KOM sprint in San Martino, Asgreen was the first on top there. Teams pulling behind, basically looking like it was going to be a sprint, was Alpecin, Picnic PostNL, and Vismalisa bike. At 33 to go, gap was less than a minute. However, 22.7 to go. The road narrowed, sort of a little bit of a, yeah, kind of halfway piece of road. There was a big crash. A rider, I believe it was Mads Petersen. In front of him, a rider from Bahrain Merida. Brian Victorious, Ben Turner, Bernal Ciccone. A lot of guys hit the deck. Ciccone was worst off. It took him a very long time. I first thought he was not actually going to get back on his bike. He did definitely wait. He was lost on GC after today. Get back to that later. Interestingly enough, panic arose because a lot of riders were not in the first part of the peloton. And at this point, Vismalisa bike were already pulling to prepare, first of all, to catch the break and then to prepare the sprint for Koi. So the situation then coming into the two laps they were doing was Bernal and Roglic were not in the first group. Neither was Ayuso, and Tiberi, who also went down, was further back.
I also eventually made it up to the first group. However, they were a minute and nine after Askren. Tiberi was in a group of his own with his teammates, 2 minutes down. Situation then, with 19 kilometers to go, the chasing group behind Askren, and when he was still in the breakaway group, 54 seconds with 8 kilometers, 17 seconds. Koi was suffering a little bit at this point, and then Pellizzari in the group with Roglic started to really turn on the gas. Bernal was up there as well. Tiberi was trying to work to diminish the gap as well. Around 6 kilometers from finish, Askren attacked. Kind of almost looked like one of those attacks we would see in the Tour de France to get the Prix Combatif. However, it was a lot more than that, because then with 4 kilometers to go, he had 15 seconds to the pink jersey group, a minute and six to the Ayuso Roglic group, 2 minutes and four to the Ayuso to the Tiberi group. He won the stage. He was 16 seconds ahead of the pink jersey group. He was 104 behind Roglic Ayuso. He was 2 minutes in front of Tiberi. So that in normalized GC time means that he was 48 seconds time lost to the Roglic Ayuso group, 144 to Tiberi in GC, normalized GC terms. So, the situation as it stands, Daniel.
Lots of red and green arrows signifying that riders have changed places on general classification.
Exactly. So taking it from the top, Ayuso lost time today. He's down one spot. He is now 126 after his teammate, Isaac Del Toro. Carapaz is up 2 places. Derek G is up 4 places. Tiberi is down 5 places. He is now 3 minutes and 2 seconds behind. Roglic is he's in the same position in the GC, but he's now 2:23 behind.
Let's run down the top 10, shall we, of the general classification. Is Isaac Del Toro leads the Giro d'Italia. Second is now Simon Yates, the lesser seen Simon Yates. We haven't seen much of him in the mix zone, certainly. He is now 1 minute and 20 seconds down. Ayuso third, 1:26. Then Carapaz fourth, 2:07. Roglic fifth, 2:23. G, 2:54. Caruso, he has moved up way ahead of his teammates. Tiberi, he's 2:55. Tiberi comes next at 3:02. Then Bernal, 3:38. And Arensman is now in the top 10. And Brian, you mentioned the other movers and shakers or sort of fallers on general classification. Where is Roglic? I'm looking for Roglic.
Roglic is fifth.
Oh, I already mentioned Roglic. Of course, I already did. Yeah. And we've got Adam Yates as well, who's lost another 3 places for 47. Well, there's a lot to digest there, chaps. That was an excellent summary nonetheless, Brian.
Thank you.
Bruno Pizzul would have been proud. Very famous Italian football commentator whose hometown we went through, Pellacci, with about 50 kilometres to go. I thought I'd just mention Bruno Pizzul because one of the things I know about Bruno Pizzul was that he was briefly became a bit of a public enemy in Italy, because on the night when Italy were eliminated from the World Cup in 1990, he talked about how beautiful the Bay of Naples was looking that night. And this earned him a lot of, well, condemnation from the Italian public. But
why?
Because it was seen as poor taste, because Italy had just been knocked out. And he talked about how beautiful the Bay of Naples was looking. And I mentioned that also because the Bay of Naples last night was, well, it was enveloped in the euphoria of
fireworks.
And fireworks. There were fireworks because Napoli had just won Lo Scudetto. And Ciro, of course, our own, very own Ciro Scognamiglia, was among those rejoicing. He wasn't in Naples. He was at the Giro d'Italia. We'll maybe hear from Ciro later. But, Brian, at the end of the Processo alla Tappa, traditionally, you asked me a question.
Yes, and that question is, Daniel, you were exiting the Sala Stampa, and who
did
you talk
statement.
To?
The question is, who did I speak to? It was Carlos Verona, who, of course, was one of those riders who was helping to shepherd his teammate Giulio Ciccone in, and we will hear again from the Motown maestro, Larry Warbass. The interview with Larry is interrupted somewhat by the Frecce Tricolori. Pellacci, just explain quickly what the Frecce Tricolori are.
They are sort of a demonstration team of the Italian Air Force. They show up, they put big colors in the air with some, you know, chemical substance, and they are involved with some polemica recently because 2 years ago they had an accident where a pilot died. A couple of weeks ago, actually.
Yeah, I saw it in Pantelleria.
In Pantelleria, yeah. They had a collision in the air and the planes were damaged. So, yeah, I don't know.
I was thinking about that incident when I saw on the screen and I heard them just above the Sala Stampo, the finish area. I was like, oh, this is not really what we need right now after today.
They dared to interrupt three times the Motown Maestro.
Exactly, and Motown Maestro. And this is a historic interview with the Motown Maestro because you've got me standing in Italy and him standing in Slovenia. Shades of the other day on San Pellegrino in Alpe, where we ordered a coffee in Tuscany and picked it up in Emilia Romagna.
Carlos, you all seem to come down there, a lot of the team. Were you one of the guys who crashed?
No, I was behind, and yeah, I mean, cycling, no? Like from the sky to the ground in seconds, but it is like it is. We need to take the positives. Luckily, we are all here in the finish because at some point it looks like we will lose Chico, but now we are all here, so we have to take the positives.
One of the riders told me that they thought it might be a metal grid on the road that you slipped on.
No, I think here it's super slippery. When it's raining, the metal pieces are like ice. And I think there was a stress for everyone not to be in the front because also the circuit was quite technical. And yeah, this happens in cycling.
Any idea how Giulio is? Any idea how he's feeling?
A big hit in the muscle, in the right muscle. But we'll see. I think now he needs to recover and we'll see if tomorrow he can start.
Carlos, thank you. Well, Larry, a lot of chaos that we didn't really expect. Maybe we should have expected it with the conditions, but I guess you were in the peloton with 23k to go when it all happened. What did you see?
Yeah, I was like right behind the crash. So in the end, you know, we went pretty full gas up the...
We're in Italy. This side of the street is Italy. That side is Slovenia.
Oh, really? Ah, okay.
God,
first time podcasting in two countries at once. Yeah, so we went full gas up these climbs with like before we came into the circuit. And then it was like, you know, the rain started. It was a pretty technical descent. So Bora or whatever, Green Red Bull, went to the front. And they try to, like, take the descent pretty slow. So I think, actually, that was a slight mistake because then more guys came back. We come onto the circuit, and, yeah, it was super technical. So when we came into this one pinch point with, like, the cobbles or bricks, I don't know, there was one area where it just super narrowed down. And on the inside, there was a metal grate, like a metal cover. And I'm pretty sure it was just one of the guys on Trek hit that, slid out, and took out his entire team. So, like, everyone on Trek went down. But it was such a narrow spot. Say it was, like, 3-4 meters wide. It was fully blocked, so no one could get through. And, yeah, so then I guess 19 guys stayed in front. Then I was in the group just behind. But then when we hit the climb and then the resulting descent, that also split on the descent. So there was a ton of GC guys everywhere. I mean, I saw Ciccone was, like, very far behind because he was definitely on the ground until... It took me a while to get going. I didn't crash, but just to get around the guys. And, yeah, then in my group there was, like, McNulty and Adam Yates. I saw Ayuso was with Storer, who was in the main group, you know. And so, yeah, I think there was a lot of guys who lost a lot of time, so... Yeah, chaos. To be honest, when I saw those guys down, I thought it was going to be like Napoli. They would neutralize it, but... Yeah. But how can you neutralize a stage when you reserved all these rocket ships to fly over us?
Yeah, yeah. We've got this historic podcast opportunity of, you know, you being in a different country to me. But, Larry, there might be some polemica tonight because, obviously, they did carry on racing and there are GC gaps as a result, but... I don't know what the consensus will be in the morning, whether that was a fair decision or not.
I mean, I guess it's bike racing, you know? We've had this discussion a few nights at the dinner table. Storer thinks they should neutralize every non-mountain stage from 100Ks to go, but I mean, I think racing's racing, even if sometimes it's, I don't know, doesn't work out the way we want.
Well, chaps, I said there was a lot to digest. Let's get one thing out of the way straight away. I tried to sort of get a rise out of Lucky Larry, or try to poke him on this issue of Visma Lisa bike riding and continuing to ride and effectively opening up that gap to the other GC riders, when those gaps had really, they'd come about because of a crash, let's face it. And it just seems, I mean, I'm not saying I disagree with it, but it seemed to me analogous with situations that we've seen over the last few years, particularly in the Tour de France, where there has been a neutralization. A neutralization that's not been enforced by the commissaires, but it's been self-enforced by the peloton. That didn't happen today. Is there any, have either of you got any issues with that?
I don't think so. It was, you know, you can't stop ciclismo from happening, right? There is not much you can do.
Is there a difference? Should we establish straight away? Is there a difference between ciclismo and cycling?
Absolutely, yes. Of course. Ciclismo, the real cycling that happens at the Giro d'Italia. Exactly.
Okay. Brian, what do you make of that?
I dig that. Well, no, I agree. Also, I love that, ciclismo. But I also think one thing, that a collateral thing that goes into that discussion that we might as well add to this is, was it okay for Jumbo Visma then to just...
Yeah, that's what I was getting at.
Yeah, so let's put the neutralization aside. And absolutely. And here's why. They were already pulling. They were already busy trying to catch the breakaway and making it as hard as possible for everyone else to line everything up for the sprint. So because of that, I think their alibi was perfectly fine. However...
Had they been pulling all day? We were out on an adventure. We'll hear more about that later, but
they had done just as much work, if not more, than the others,
because they had the alibi of going for the stage win.
Yeah.
Had it just been a question of general classification, had they been clearly transparently pulling to get Simon Yates further down the road, you know, ahead of his GC riders, then it might have been a different conversation.
Here's the issue that arises out of that, because then after the crash happened, other motives came into pulling even harder. But there, I think once that situation has been established, right, then they need to continue with whatever they're doing. And then they obviously sacrificed riders to open up that gap for Simon Yates. And I think that's perfectly fine in that situation now that that chain of events has eventuated. So we saw Visma Lisa bike riders dropping out because they had, like, you know, worn themselves out, including Wout van Aert, who would normally be a lead-out guy for Olaf Koy. So they at that point, gave up on leading anything out for Koy and worked entirely for the sake of bringing Simon Yates further up in the GC. But then my point is that once that chain of events started, then after that, I think it's perfectly normal and perfectly legitimate to then do what they did. That is ciclismo.
Pelacci is nodding and smiling in approval. I do agree with you. I'm kind of playing devil's advocate. I also think that team deserves to be rewarded for bringing strong rulers to a race and riders who are going to position their GC contender, which is the case with Visma Lisa bike. And was it a rider error? I mean, we heard about the circumstances of the crash from Carlos Verona and from Larry. Indeed, there seemed to be some kind of metal grille on the road which caused the initial problem, and also the road narrowing. It seems to be the riders. Well, it was the riders who were further back in the peloton who were affected. We all know you should ride as far forward in the peloton as possible. And I think Isaac Del Toro is a great sort of test case in this, in the sense that yet again, and Pelacci and I were talking about this on the way back to the press room, yet again he found himself in the right place, and he is not necessarily doing it because he's being brilliantly escorted and brilliantly protected by teammates. He's doing it because he's showing great nous and racing instinct, and that deserved, I suppose, to be rewarded as well.
It's an interesting puzzle of gray area where the pieces sort of where they tie together. I think there's a vagueness here that I want to address with you, Pelacci, in the whole context of ciclismo. Had Del Toro crashed and had a gap been built up
to a point where he would have lost the jersey, do you think the discussion would have been any different?
It's interesting. He said in a press conference that from the team car, it was said to him, be chill, don't crash, and go to the finish line. He hit the deck as well, involved in a crash, not because of his fault, but then he sprinted and made it back to the first group. I think he has both this aura that reminds me of Pogacar, right? This aura of untouchability, so to speak. You can't... It seems like he can't do anything wrong, right? Anything wrong happens to him somehow. In a way or another, he's always in the positive side of things.
But however, you should still...
I think it would be... this is where it becomes sort of laced and intertwined with cycling dogma and silly traditions, because it shouldn't be any different for the pink jersey.
But no, that was what I was angling for.
But it probably would have been. And then there would have been much more polemica tonight,
yeah, exactly.
Which is ridiculous. Because objectively, they're the same situation. And we know how close the general classification is. There are effectively, you know, there were 10 riders this morning who could have won the general classification. And really, they all deserve the same kind of treatment from the rest of the peloton.
Fully agree.
But... well, we saw what happened, and yet another crash from Primoz Roglic. James Knox actually told me, we didn't hear from James Knox there, he definitely saw Roglic down. Other people have referred to a Roglic crash as well. I didn't notice that he was injured or bleeding. Mainly he was fighting through the Slovenian fans with a smile on his face after the finish. He was obviously, well, he got a fantastic reception after the finish, but Roglic's chances have taken another dent, and Simon Yates's have been boosted considerably, and also Juan Ayuso's have taken another considerable dent as well. Other conclusions, Brian? Well, Tiberi's out, pretty much out. He's lost five places. He's now, I mean, he hasn't lost that much time. Three minutes.
Calling him out, I think it's that's premature. I think seeing what's still left of the Giro, he still has a very homogenous team. Unless he's hurt physically, I still believe the podium is definitely a possibility for him. Once again, Carapaz doesn't miss a beat. His ability to position himself, and that's even with Asgreen, who's sort of his bodyguard up front, taking a victory for himself. Honoré did that job instead. No, I think, you know, there are certain riders who just, you know, really good at placing themselves. We even saw that. You remember the first year when Bernal was even in the crosswind, Bernal is always good. So there's just riders who are good at that, and some less so. And it will be very interesting now, because you can't say that with Del Toro and Ayuso, it's definitive, and you certainly can't have. They certainly won't say it either. But it's starting to sort of be a little bit. I don't know. We'll see. Well, tomorrow we'll be telling, but then again, not so much. And when we go into the first rest day, the questions will start to be probably a little bit more poignant to them about it.
Yeah. That second group actually did limit the losses. I don't know whether they rode a very fast last couple of kilometers, but when I was sort of, when everyone sort of scrambled to get interviews with the first group over the line, the time gap stood at about a minute. So they did reduce that quite a bit. I don't know who was pulling at that point, but to get it down to, well, it was 40 something seconds at the end, wasn't it? Was a decent effort. So nothing lost on that front, but again, more problems for Primoz Roglic. The circuit itself around Nova Gorica, Brian, there was a lot of, well, we're looking out over a similar piece of road to the one where Ciccone crashed, and also Pellacci and I were at the finish line, and just beyond the finish line there was a stretch of very sort of slick tiles, cobbles, which could have been precarious as well. And obviously the organisers can't legislate for the weather, for the rain. The weather wasn't as bad as the last time we came here, and Victor Campenaerts won, but it was another one of those gnarly circuits, and particularly that bit where the crash happened, the road narrowed, and yet very, very precarious indeed.
Yeah, and apparently it was a high footpath. They had like a high lip or something. So yeah, it's just one of those things where, yeah, who can you really blame? I mean, accidents happen, but it would, yeah,
Maravegna. Yeah, okay, he's Pellacci's god. Okay. Right, chaps. Well, Brian, you were in the press conference with your countryman, or you certainly listening to your countryman, Kasper.
I got the first question in, even.
There you go, Kasper Asgreen. What did we learn from that? Because he's a rider who, since his move to EF Education First, has kept a bit of a low profile. And ever since he won the Tour of Flanders, obviously he had that great Tour de France where he won one stage and came within millimetres of another one. But besides that, well, it's been a story.
It's been a story of
light and shade.
A year of 249 days since his last win. He talked about that, and he also talked about. Initially the Giro wasn't in the cards for him, but he fell sick before the races where he was actually supposed to. He was signed for his new team, EF Education First, as a captain for the couple of races, but he got sick. And then the Giro was added to his program, which obviously turned into a really great idea. He's found shape, he's found new inspiration on the team, and the trust they've shown him, and the patience they've had with him. You know, not an easy situation coming in as a bigger name, you'd say, having won Tour Flanders as you mentioned. And this is a big relief for him. It's been a very long drought, victory wise, for him, and. Sort of the same way that he you know, when he won the stage in the Tour, he has a huge engine, and it seems like it certainly opened up again for what he's capable of. I think both him and the team will be very relieved with that. And now, I mean, they're still in, as you mentioned also, they're still here for Carapaz, and now with two stage wins, this year is really looking bright for them.
Brian, did anyone ask him, or did he talk about wearing an aero helmet? Because I noticed this morning that the chaps from Picnic Post NL were not wearing their aero helmets. And we speculated after Casper Van Uden's victory in Lecce that everyone would soon be wearing their aero helmets. Obviously, each team has a different sponsor and they all have sort of different versions and different ideas about what constitutes an aero helmet. But the chaps from Picnic have not worn them since, in fact, if I'm not mistaken. And I did ask this morning how come they weren't today. And they felt that the finale, with the climbs in the finale, was going to be, well, not a typical sprint finale. And that was the explanation they gave. But
average today was 47.8.
Yes, but they didn't think it was going to be a sprint in the same way that Lecce was. So that was their reasoning. But obviously, Asgreen, well, he had his eyes on a break today, and hence that was why he wore probably, well, the aero helmet.
Certainly wasn't for the looks.
No, it wasn't for the looks. But who was? Oh, it was Casper Van Uden, wasn't it, who said something along the lines after his victory that fast is more important than sexy or something. I don't know. Is that 6 minutes? Okay, we've got to pay. The bar is closing in 6 minutes. We can finish the part. We can finish the part before we have to go and pay. Chaps, it is time for the chiacchierata del giorno, I believe. The chinwag of the day, which, as we know, this week has had a theme. Every one of my conversation partners has been linked in some way to the pink jersey, Isaac del Toro. Yesterday we heard from his agent, Alex Carrera. Today, something a little bit different. I thought we'd hear from one of his peers, but someone who has beaten Isaac del Toro and maybe knows how to beat him in the mountains. Of course, we've got a lot of mountains coming up over the next few days in the Giro d'Italia. Darren Rafferty belongs to the team that won today, EF Education First. And in 2023, just before Isaac del Toro won the Tour de l'Avenir, Darren Rafferty vanquished Isaac del Toro in the Giro della Val d'Aosta. In fact, Isaac del Toro was third and Darren Rafferty was first. So yesterday in, where were we yesterday? Rovigo, I thought I would summon Darren Rafferty to the mix zone to ask him about his experience in that Giro della Val d'Aosta, and also for a bit of a sort of reflection on what it's like to be a young rider who's heavily tipped, heavily touted as a big young star, and to not necessarily experience the same fast track first couple of years as Isaac Del Toro and to not, for example, be leading a Grand Tour already in your second year as a professional. So we're going to hear that now. Here is the Chiacchierata del Giorno with Darren Rafferty.
La Chiacchierata del Giorno, the chin wag of the day.
So Darren, well, first of all, I wanted to ask you, you know how to beat Isaac Del Toro because you beat him at the Val d'Aosta 2 years ago. For those, well, not many people will have seen that race. Just tell us the story. What do you remember of that race, which was obviously a big result for you under 23 level?
Yeah, it feels like a while ago now. Probably not too many great results since, but yeah, it was a nice race. I really like racing in Italy. I think one of the nicest, if not the nicest country to race in. Just, yeah, the people, yeah, how the roads are, everything. I think Val d'Aosta was probably it's the most difficult under 23 race, I think. And I probably just won it by, yeah, just being consistent every day. I think one stage went on a bit of a solo mission and then kind of bridged across the break, and that's where I gained back most of my time. But yeah, raced Isaac there. I think he won. He was like also just behind the winner on the last stage. So yeah, it's been unbelievably strong this Giro. It's really nice to see someone so young showing almost dominance and racing a Grand Tour pretty impressively, actually. Racing for sprints, racing like already three times second at the Giro. It's commendable. I think what he's done is, yeah, it's very nice to see. Also gives me some hope for the future that, you know, I can still keep improving. But in general, it's been a really nice Giro so far. Richie's been doing a great job, and it's cool to be here for my second Grand Tour and testing out the road to Giro.
Danny, would you, if I'd asked you back then to sort of tip who were going to be the guys you race with regularly under 23, who going to be the guys who would sort of make a big impact as pros pretty early on, do you think you would have got it right? You would have known which guys it was going to be?
No, I don't think so. I think people like to tend to think that the results translate directly, but I think you can take lots of riders that have been on a pretty steep upward trajectory. Some people have kind of consistently level. Some people that have got, yeah, almost faded away. I think there's a lot expected of the new young riders. Everyone has this expectation that new pros, neo pros should be at the level to win or race, but I think there's a lot more to it than just the legs. There's a lot of new changes, a lot of experienced riders to learn from, and I think in general, yeah, it's interesting for me to see the people around me. Some have got a lot better, some haven't improved at the same rate as myself, and I think the best thing is to try and avoid comparison, you know. For me, I'm just trying to do my own thing. Yeah, respect whenever good riders have done incredible results, and also know that there's people that are struggling with the switch to the pro ranks as well. So I think the big name that people would have been shouting a couple of years ago was Johannes Thonemitet. I think he's one of the really strong under 23s, and he's already switched team in the World Tour. So not everything, I think, goes as smoothly as sometimes as people think. But yeah, I think everyone gets to their destination somewhere along the line.
I guess you arrived right at that point in time as well when there was this kind of cult of youth which had developed because of Pogacar and Bernal as well. You know, Bernal won the Tour at 21 or 22. How much have you sort of sensed that?
Yeah, well, I think I already sensed it after my first year under 23 when there was some kind of chat about going World Tour and teams offering contracts, this, that, and the other. And personally, I just didn't feel ready. And I loved my time at Hagens Berman Axion. Thought it was extremely relaxed environment, good friends, all around the same age. Felt like we could develop at a really nice rate. And then I think this mid-second year when I got some decent results, there's that kind of anticipation that you need to go World Tour. If you don't now, it's now or never. So I think, yeah, I feel like it's been a nice step. I've had already 1 year under my belt and enjoying this second year as much as I can.
Just ask you one more, Darren. Obviously, you got a big week coming up and you're going to try and beat Isaac Del Toro with Richard. Just how are you thinking about the next week and your role as well?
Yeah, I think every day it's just trying to keep Richard safe until we get to next week. And then I think when we get into the high mountains, that's where he thrives. That's where he can do his thing the best. And he's already showed on some medium mountain stages how strong he is, the level he's at, and also the commitment from the team to put him in the right place at the right time. So, yeah, I'm hoping the condition just keeps improving and I can be there as deep into the stage each day as possible.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing place with now it's very sleepy and it's quite a small town, but on off the beaten track. But for 100 years or so, it was really a flashpoint borderland, you know, between Italian speaking, what became Yugoslavia, Slovenia. So real a place of a kind of a contested place between various countries. And that is, you know, led to enormous conflict and to the town basically being flattened more than once during war. So it's this place with this kind of deep traumatic history, which you can kind of feels a bit weird when you walk around it today, because it feels such a kind of gentrified and well-to-do and quite boring place, which is really odd. But it actually wasn't that at all for so long. And it was really a place that many countries wanted, a very strategic place on right on the border for decades.
In the barest possible terms, before World War One, was it Italy? Was it not Italy? Was it Austria? What was it?
It was in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but it was somewhere that Italy wanted, you know, and that when you have the First World War breaks out in 1915, Italy wants those lands. That's its kind of its main aims of this bloody long conflict, which goes on for far longer than most people thought. And Gorizia is kind of, if you don't get Gorizia, there's really no point going to war.
Well, chaps, that was a little clip from a podcast we did a couple of years ago, two or three years ago, in fact. I think the last time we were here when Victor Campanaz, probably 4 years ago now, won. And we heard there from John Foote, who is our resident sort of historian. He is the professor of modern Italian history at Bristol University. And he was talking there about Gorizia and the key role that Gorizia played in the First World War. But look that podcast up. I said it yesterday. It's a very good primer on this very, very interesting part of the world that, unfortunately, we'll be leaving in just a few minutes, in fact, because we'll be heading back west to where we came from this morning. Pelacci has got his head in his hands. I don't know why, Pelacci.
Because we're going back closer and closer to the Veneto.
The United States of the Veneto, my favorite region, Pelacci's least favorite region. We had the regional president, Zaya, in the mix zone this morning, and Pelacci was sort of cowering in the corner. Zaya is a very visible politician, isn't he? He's a very, I don't want to call him Trumpian or Berlusconian, but Brian is sort of suggesting.
Yeah, kind of.
Anyway, chaps, we are in Gorizia. We have been in Gorizia all afternoon, and Pelacci, we decided this afternoon that we were going to set out on a bit of an adventure. I don't know how much to reveal about this before we hear what we got up to in regards to the 1983 Giro d'Italia. Pelacci, do you want to add a couple of details before the listeners hear what we did?
I was minus 15 years old at that age, so I had no idea what was going on. Daniel explained it to me as a lassativo, a substance.
Laxative. It involves laxative. It's like a murder mystery tour, isn't it?
Exactly. Put in the minestrone or not. Let's hear this.
Laxatives, minestrones, policemen in Gorizia that we might be able to find, we might not. Giuseppe Saronni, the pink jersey. Oh, it's all here. Stay tuned. Pelacci, your baptism of fire. This is your first cycling podcast adventure that I'm taking you on. This is your first excursion, 40 pista, off piste as we say. We're in the back streets of Nova Gorizia. Stop laughing. We are just very close to the finish line and we're looking for what, right, you're saying I need to go right. What, Michele, what address are we looking for here?
you're looking for some address that I don't know the number, but in Via Teobaldo Cicconi in Nova Gorizia, and we're looking for a...
We don't ruin the surprise. Tell me which address we're looking for, because I need to park this car.
I think this is good.
Okay.
Right here.
Okay. Michele, we're looking for 32B. Michele, last time I... Pelacci, I'm not calling you Michele. Last time I did this, doorstep someone for a cycling publication or media. It was Jamaluddin Abdujaparov somewhere on Lake Garda. But, and I didn't find him. 32A, 32B. Now, we're looking for a gentleman called Massimo Luznik. I'll tell you why in a minute. Cut, no. He's not here, is he? Luznik. Cardly, what we've got? Cardly Rotterdam. Wow, that's, yeah, it's nothing like Luznik. Just check the other. Well, Michele, we'll just double check what it says on
32B, yeah.
32B.
Maybe on the other side of this.
Luznik. Scusi, signore. Salve, scusi. Abita qua un Massimo Luznik? Non ci posso credere. Ma noi siamo col Giro d'Italia. Lei è stato il poliziotto che ha fermato il signore che voleva avvelenare Saronni nell'83. Sì? Può scendere. Non ci posso credere.
C'era una persona che conoscevo, un ragazzo che conoscevo, che lavorava in questa pizzeria a Gorizia.
Internazionale,
hotel? All'hotel internazionale, sì, c'era ristorante e pizzeria, c'è anche più. Ovviamente mi ha raccontato che era stato avvicinato da una persona che seguiva il Giro d'Italia, credo che poi è emerso.
Grazie,
okay. Buona giornata, grazie.
Vai Pelacci, go. Ah, Pelacci, what? Well, I'm lost for words, man. So, Pelacci, last year with the Barone, we went on an adventure looking for the hotel where Eddie Merckx was informed that he tested positive in Savona, and we found what used to be the hotel, and that was thanks to a woman on a balcony in the street. And I thought that was some pretty fine investigative work. However, what I think we've just surpassed it. So the story, we haven't told the story so far, so let's tell the story. 1983, the night before the last stage of the Giro d'Italia, it's a time trial from Gorizia, where we are now, to Udine. In the pink jersey is Beppe Saronni. In his hotel that night, the Hotel Internazionale here in Gorizia, there is a gentleman who works for a company that supplies rims to Roberto Visentini, who's just over a minute behind Saronni on general classification. And what does this gentleman do? Well, he gets chatting to the waiters in the restaurant, and he supposedly offers them some money in return for them poisoning Saronni with some laxative called Gutalax, is the name of the product.
It's not clear if he was supposed to put the Gutalax himself in the minestrone or let someone else put the Gutalax in the minestrone, but that's it.
He wants the waiters to collaborate with this in return for, I think it was 2 million lira or 3 million lira. What do these waiters do? This is what I'd read anyway, Pelacci. They contact the local police. Now, in my research about this story, this fatto di cronaca, as they say in Italian, I had found the name of the policeman from Gorizia who they had contacted and brought to the Hotel Internazionale, or who'd come to the Hotel Internazionale, and who ultimately had foiled this plot. Because what had this policeman done? He dressed up as a waiter, supposedly, according to the reports, and he had caught the malfeasant, the culprit, the guilty party, in flagrante, red-handed. And it wasn't entirely clear what had happened next. Well, it was, what was clear was that, as I said, the plot had been foiled and Saronni wasn't poisoned. He went on to win the Giro d'Italia. But this gentleman, this policeman, Massimo Luznik, I found his name, but that was all I was able to find, and I wanted to track him down. Well, I say it was all I managed to find. I found one other thing online. It was an address. No phone number, no other references really to him on the internet, apart from something about, again, he's a policeman, having been honoured for having rescued a senior citizen from a burning building about 20 years ago. There were literally three links. The address, there was this one about the burning building, and there was another one about an old colleague that he'd honoured when this old colleague had retired. So very little to go on, but this address, we thought we'd give it a shot. So up we rocked about 40 minutes ago. We went to the address, well, we went to where we thought the address was, and we couldn't see anything or anyone, and we looked at the names on the gate, and there was no Luznik. However, you then suggested just going around the corner, going around the back of the same building, and we found a different entrance, and we found a different set of names on the gates. And there we saw Luznik. Then what did we see, Pelacci?
We saw a man on the balcony, and we were thinking, looking at each other, saying, could that be him? Is it possible that it's literally up there and we are seeing him already? And it was really Massimo Luznik staring in front of us with a sort of straniato look. How do you say?
Looking disoriented. I mean, yeah. I said that we were speechless. I'm speechless now. He was speechless when I said to him, we heard him just then. I asked him, are you Massimo Luznik? Did Massimo Luznik used to live here? Or does he live here? Because we're here for the Giro d'Italia, and we were looking for the policeman who foiled the dastardly plot to poison Beppe Saronni in 1983. He then came down the steps, and after sort of gathering himself a little bit, he started to tell us the story, what he remembered of the story, and he confirmed all the details, didn't he, really, Pelacci? Even down to having somehow, from somewhere, found a white waiter's uniform. And as we said, caught the gentleman, the rim supplier, Roberto Visentini's rim supplier, who, you know, was the guy who was behind the attempted poisoning, having caught him in flagrante. He said he didn't arrest him. He couldn't arrest him. What did he explain about that, Pelacci?
There was no, so many probes were not enough to put him in jail, basically. So
not
he was
enough proof.
Exactly.
Well, the other thing that happened, Pelacci, was that he complimented me on my investigative work. He complimented me a few times as though he was sort of sizing me up for a role in the Polizia di Gorizia that he used to work for.
Yeah, it was incredible scenes, because later he invited us upstairs to take a coffee with him and his wife. And the scene that I will remember forever was that his wife, the three of us talking, and his wife. Lovely woman, she was making coffee, smoking a cigarette, and talking at the phone. Prototypical, traditional Italian nonna doing her stuff, so lovely conversation.
Lovely conversation. The conversation didn't flow quite as well when I noted that Massimo was wearing an Inter t-shirt. Inter, of course, lost the Italian football championship, lo Scudetto, last night. But Pelacci, what an adventure it was, and when we were on our way here, I said I thought we had about 20% chance based on past experience of finding this gentleman, and we happened upon him on his balcony. We have great luck with balconies in Italy at the Giro, so next year's equivalent off-piste adventure must involve a balcony.
Well, Brian, you haven't heard that yet. That was quite remarkable. Shades of our little trip in Savona last year. And, well, as we heard there, it sounds as though I've got a future as a private investigator.
Well, I've been following your work in the car, trying to track this man down. And I'm very impressed by the fact that you actually finally did.
I'm not exactly changing the world, though, doing this, am I? I'm tracking down policemen who had a minor role. Not really a minor role, quite a major role in the history of the Giro d'Italia. How many years ago did we say it was, Pellacci? 1983? Quick maths. I can't. Pellacci, just say it. 43. Okay. yes.
It is a radio show, you know.
You're not really made, not really made for podcasting. Oh yeah, Pellacci. Maybe we have to reconsider, make a different, may assign someone else for the next week. Brian, can you stay on another week?
No.
Anyway, that was today's adventure. What a great story. Skullduggery at the Giro d'Italia. It's a common recurring theme, isn't it? And it has been over the course of our 10 years now at the Giro d'Italia, on the ground every day. But it's time now not to talk about the past, but to talk about the future and particularly tomorrow's stage. That's after we've talked also about yesterday's dinner.
La tappa di domani, la cena di ieri. Tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner.
Brian, any notes from yesterday's dinner? Excellent cheese. We had a fantastic antipasto of cheese.
Yeah, it's something that I always... It's hard for me to really consider an antipasto, but if I have a sort of an idea that they have good cheese, I always try to fit it in somewhere. If I have that protein urge, which I had last night.
You definitely had a protein urge last night.
Yeah, I did. And I thought it was wonderful. You and I both agreed on that. And we had a delightful Barbera from Bovio, which I remember actually they used to have own a wonderful restaurant in La Mora. Restaurant that's now been bought by the estate of Giacomo Conterno, but it was a nice evening. We stayed at a nice, friendly hotel as well.
Asparagus risotto, that was very good. So they had some sort of kind of Parmesan ersatz, which was made from liver, from cow's liver that they were shaving over the asparagus risotto. I obviously passed on that.
It was their version of Butarga made from meat.
It was exactly. But chaps, let's talk, shall we, about tomorrow's stage. We have the climb of Monte Grappa, and we also have the climb to Asiago, also famous, very famous for its cheese.
Too famous.
We all agreed earlier, is a fairly nondescript cheese, a bit like Gouda, a bit like Dutch Gouda or Edam. Doesn't taste of a whole lot. But anyway, tomorrow's stage goes to Asiago. It's a mountain stage of sorts, and it will be a very beautiful stage. Monte Grappa, famous location in Italian cycling. Let's hear, shall we, before we discuss it, from two chaps who ought to know Monte Grappa extremely well, because they are both from the town at the bottom, the beautiful town at the bottom of Monte Grappa, Bassano del Grappa. We're going to hear from Francesco Busato from Intermarché, and we are going to hear from Marco Frigo from Israel Premier Tech. Now, we discovered last year that Marco Frigo, in fact, doesn't know Monte Grappa very well, or didn't know it very well at all. In fact, he'd almost never ridden to the top. I set out yesterday to find out whether that was still the case. So here they are, Francesco Busato and Marco Frigo. Francesco, next to you is a rider, Marco Frigo, who I asked last year about Monte Grappa, and I was amazed that he'd never done it outside of races. You're from Bassano del Grappa. I imagine that you have done Monte Grappa a number of times.
Yeah, I've done it not a lot of time because it's a quite long climb and super hard, in my opinion. But yeah, I've done it a few times, and but I think never in race. So it will be the first time Sunday.
And there are 9 or 10 ways at Monte Grappa. I think you're doing the Strada Cadorna, I think, the easiest way, I suppose. And which is your favourite way that you've done?
My favourite way is from Semonzo. It's the one that they've done twice last year. It's the hardest one, but it's also one of the shortest. So you can be on top more or less after 1 hour 10, if you climb well, 1 hour if you're super strong. So it's my favorite.
Do you ever go up there for anything other than cycling? There are lots of sort of restaurants up there, people go hiking up there. Do you ever go up there?
I went walking up to Monte Grappa many times in winter. So I know the place really well, and it's also super beautiful.
And how well do you know Marco? Do you train together?
Yeah, we live close. We train also together, and he's a bit older than me, so when we were younger, he was winning a lot, so I knew already him. But then we became pro cyclists, and of course we know each other because we are not a lot in the area, so yeah, we also train together sometimes. Yeah.
And last thing, is your fans club, your fan club, is it as big as his?
It will be in Vicenza for sure. Yeah, the finish.
Are there as many people as there are in his?
I don't know actually. I know he has a quite big fan club, but now it's a bit smaller. Yeah.
Grazie. Ciao, ciao. Marco, straight on to you. Now, last year you told me you'd never done Monte Grappa once. You've done it in a race. Please tell me that in the last 12 months you've at least trained on it a couple more times.
I trained a couple of times, and actually I did it once before Lombardia full Grappa, and I did also the downhill to Caupo. It will be an important downhill on Sunday. So we'll see. But
you're learning to love Monte Grappa, finally.
It's a climb. The first 20 minutes of the climb I did like 100, 200 times. I didn't count. The total climb I did only a few times, but it's a climb I really love. And also the climb to Asiago, right, to be honest.
And we've got Francesco here. You've obviously known him for quite a long time. Just talk to me about his potential as a rider. He's only 22 in his first year.
No, Francesco, I know him. We live, we are born like a few kilometers from each other. I know him since he was five. And
five? Why did you know him?
No, because when I started cycling, I was nine. Or I was eight. He was just a few years younger. So I always saw him growing up. He did some big step into cycling. And today he's going to be there to fight in the Giro, no? So it means that he grew up a lot. And to fight in a final like this, you need the legs, and he has the legs.
Pelacci, you have ridden most of the major climbs in Italy now. Are you familiar with Monte Grappa?
Not because of my riding up there, but we drove through up there last year with my former podcast that I did in Italian, and it was great. It's so cool to be up there. The climb is just so long. It looks like it never ends. I know tomorrow will be sort of the easier side of the Grappa, the easiest even. There are more than 10 sides, I think. You can sort of mix them up and compose the climb however you want. Tomorrow will be sort of easy, but still, 25 kilometers, 6% average almost. It will be tough. It will be tough, and who forgets the leg at home, it will be in danger tomorrow.
Monte Grappa, ciclismo or cycling?
100% ciclismo.
100% ciclismo. That's the ultimate Pelacci seal of approval. Brian, I've been hearing from riders this week that it's definitely going to be a breakaway tomorrow. That doesn't necessarily mean that we're not going to have time gaps on the general classification. Is it an opportunity tomorrow for the likes of Primoz Roglic to claw back some time? I think I have my answer, and it's no. Yeah, what do you think?
No, I fully agree. I'm more inclined to say that it's, you know, looking back in the last few days, that it's not real ciclismo. However, I think it would be Ineosismo. Ineos have, they have looked at inconvenient for the other teams situations in the race where they can sort of come to the fore, test the waters. They obviously don't want to do it in a way that compromises Bernal's ability to then participate in the final. But to me, it seems like they want to find these places in the parcours where they can sort of put a foot in the door in the GC hierarchy. It's just really hard to interpret the final tomorrow because, you know, it's too far from the finish. The top of the last climb is some 22, 23 kilometers from the finish is a plateau.
Remind us, Brian, of the stats of that last climb.
So the stats of the last climb is 16 kilometers, but it's an average of 5.4.
So I mean,
there are some steeper ramps, but a long climb. I would suggest there will be general classification attacks, but that's not to say that they will cause too much damage. Incidentally, I'm just remembering now that I tipped before the Giro d'Italia, I tipped Michael Storer to win tomorrow's stage. I would like to retract that tip now on the record because he's 14th on general classification. 13th on general classification, 4 minutes 25 down, and he will not be allowed in a breakaway, I would suggest, unless all hell breaks loose and the race just gets out of control.
Well, it could also be that we see a situation where UAE will start to poker it, because if a rider like Storer goes into a breakaway, he will be a concern for other teams than UAE before. They need to do something. So it could be that riders that are, you know, moving down the GC because of him will then have to start working. That could also be a formula for UAE to use if they don't really feel like they need to be pulling all day. I mean, bear in mind that it's a rest day the day after, etc.
Adam Yates, earlier on in the Giro, told me that we might not see anything on general classification until stage 16. Well, the bell is about to toll. We have, in fact, seen plenty on general classification, but mainly because of crashes. But D-Day is about to arrive. I don't know whether he meant including sort of stage 16 or until after stage 16. Hopefully it was the former. We will find out. Chaps, I propose we conclude today's episode by hearing from another one of our friends. I teased this earlier in the episode. Ciro Scogna Emilia was jubilant today because Napoli did it. They won Lo Scudetto. They saw off Inter. And I saw Ciro bounding over to meet me this morning on the team car park in Treviso. Here he is. Here we are celebrating Napoli's Scudetto victory. We'll be back tomorrow. Buonasera, Pelacci.
Ciao.
Buonasera, ciclismo.
Ciro, did you finally watch the match?
I must confess, the second half, the last 45 minutes I watched, because I was in contact with Lionel Bernie. In the first half, I told him, Lionel, I'm not watching the match, so don't give me updates. And he gave me updates with the first goal, and then at the end I decided to watch the second part.
And what about Scott McTominay? I think you need to build a shrine to Scott McTominay in Via Solferino. La Gazzetta is not in Via Solferino anymore, but at the headquarters of La Gazzetta, you need to build a shrine.
I don't know if Scott McTominay is one of our listeners. I don't think so, but in any case, I mean, who knows? Scott, I have a marvelous apartment near the beach. Come to me for an holiday, and you are the owner of my house because you are my new god. I mean, you imagine that maybe Vincenzo Nibali could have been my idol. Obviously not.
Once it was Nibali, then it was Ganna, now it's McTominay.
No, never. They never were my idols. Scott McTominay, yes. Thanks, Scotland. Thanks, Scott.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Byrne.